Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Wall Street was paying closer attention than usual to the Senate Agriculture Committee today. The committee approved sharp new limits on derivatives trading, depending to some degree on who you are. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Citrix, offering Go to My PC, allowing users to work from anywhere via the web. More at gotomypc.com/market. And by Nixon Peabody LLP, a full-service international law firm offering practical solutions for today's real-world business challenges. More at nixonpeabody.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Wednesday, the 21st of April, and it is good to have you here, everybody. All 12 Democrats and a single Republican on the Senate Agriculture Committee voted to limit derivatives trading today. Wasn't exactly a surprise. Committee Chair Blanche Lincoln said last week she really wants to crack down on the trades that helped push the financial industry right to the brink a couple of years ago. So bank lobbyists may need some consoling tonight. Derivatives are a very profitable business for those banks. But the committee's vote also recognizes that derivatives do have some legitimate uses, as Brett Neely explains from Washington.
Though I couldn't hear corks popping over the phone, Jim May of the Air Transport Association was in a good mood this afternoon.
We're delighted with Chairman Lincoln's bill.
The group he heads represents the airline industry. May says the bill will cut down the speculation on oil. That means less volatility in jet fuel prices, and that's great for airlines. As for the banks...
If Goldman Sachs makes, you know, $2.9 billion as opposed to $3.4 billion, I'm not going to shed any tears.
The bill will blunt Wall Street speculation, but it's been designed not to hurt non-financial companies that need to lock in prices on a range of goods. Banks use derivatives for pure speculation that almost brought down the economy. The bill makes speculators trade derivatives on tightly regulated public exchanges, and banks are going to have to put up collateral to buy derivatives. Airlines, oil marketers, and manufacturers successfully argued those rules would be too expensive for them. So this bill exempts companies of the legitimate business interest. Dorothy Coleman is with the National Association of Manufacturers. She says otherwise, the new rules would have taken
money out of their day-to-day business operations, money, you know, capital that should be going into investing in their business, into job creation.
This looks like a case of getting special treatment. But if airlines and others hadn't defended the bill, it never would have passed, says Michael Greenberger. He teaches law at the University of Maryland and is a former derivatives regulator.
I think it's a small price to pay to get the kind of comprehensive regulation that the bill otherwise brings to the American taxpayer and the American investing public.
The Senate will now merge this chapter on derivatives into the broader financial reform bill. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
Here's an entirely apropos question for you, given the news of the day. What is a bank? I'm not talking about the difference between an investment bank and a commercial bank here. I'm talking about the difference between, I don't know, say First Regional Bank of Boise, Idaho, and Bank of America. They look reasonably similar on the outside. They've both got brick-and-mortar branches. They make loans to small businesses. They offer checking accounts. But in all the back and forth over the new financial regulations, we are seeing a real difference emerge between them. The big banks are fighting like mad against reform, but a lot of the little guys think change is actually a good idea. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
Big banks have been making lots of money lately by doing things community banks don't do. Karen Thomas works for the Independent Community Bankers of America, a trade association. She says local and regional banks are interested in Main Street.
They're not focused on exotic derivative products and, you know, credit default swaps, and they're not internationally active.
Those profitable activities are being threatened by reforms, which is why the big Wall Street banks are fighting the proposed legislation.
Really what it comes down to is that the bigger guys are pushing away or trying to stop some areas of reform occurring that are extremely lucrative for them.
Matt McCormick is a banking analyst at Ball & Gaynor.
And any more regulations, bureaucracy, or change in those plans could potentially be harmful to future earnings and profitability and ultimately their share price.
Community banks make their money elsewhere with deposits and small loans. Karen Thomas from the Community Bankers Association says unlike the big guys, her constituents are fighting for reform.
We'd like to see an end to Too Big to Fail. We would like to see a pre-funded systemic risk fund that can be used to dissolve and liquidate a failing large institution instead of having the taxpayers bail the institution out.
Analysts say major reforms would make it easier for small banks to compete, which would be good for the economy as a whole. There'd be more lending at a local level, and the risk would be more spread out. In New York, I'm Alisa Roth for Marketplace.
Here's another question as a way to set up a story, just because that seems to be the way things are going today. Completely different topic, though. Would you consider it a violation of your privacy to have your name turned over to a tax collector? Amazon.com most certainly does feel that way. It's suing over an attempt by the state of North Carolina to target customers who've been avoiding sales taxes. A growing number of states are feuding with Amazon and other online retailers, companies that don't have to collect sales taxes in states where they don't have a physical presence. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has the latest twist.
Retail giants like Amazon and Overstock.com agree their customers are responsible for paying millions of dollars in sales taxes, but thanks to a U.S. Supreme Court ruling, they're under no obligation to collect them, which gives them a leg up on their local competition. And they haven't been much help to the strapped states that need the money. Natasha Altamirano speaks for the Tax Foundation, a Washington think tank.
The onus on paying that is on the individual taxpayer, but it's just pretty much an unenforceable tax.
North Carolina's Department of Revenue sees a way around that if Amazon will simply identify residents who've made purchases. But Amazon argues the demand is unconstitutional and claims it would discourage people from buying controversial books, music, or movies. At the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, state tax expert Michael Mazaroff sees that as a smokescreen.
People buy merchandise from Amazon that costs $1,000 or $2,000 at a pop. There's a significant amount of tax due on it, and it would be rational for the state to try to use information from Amazon to collect tax on big-ticket items.
The North Carolina Tax Agency's Beth Stevenson insists there's no need to get specific.
We're not asking for any information that would jeopardize the privacy of a consumer. The information that we are requesting and that is necessary for us to properly administer tax collection would be the type of product purchased, for example, a book, and the purchase price of that book.
Amazon said today North Carolina officials had been demanding much more and suggested the company might be willing to compromise. State and local governments have been working to standardize the tax language they use. That would help online retailers sort through more than 7,400 different tax codes across the country. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, much back and forth, in the end signifying not a whole lot. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I know we said this often during the healthcare debate, and it turned out often not to be true, but it does kind of feel like things are reaching a turning point in Congress over financial reform this time. Senate Banking Committee Chairman Christopher Dodd says he is looking to start a floor debate on reform tomorrow. Commentator Robert Reich says the bill that's under consideration is a good start.
The real scandal isn't the street's unlawful acts, such as Goldman Sachs' alleged fraud, but legal acts that have reaped the street a bonanza and nearly sunk the rest of us. The bill now being considered in the Senate is a step in the right direction, but it omits three of the most important reforms. First, it should require that all derivatives, that is, bets on future asset prices, be traded on open exchanges, where parties have to disclose what they're buying and selling and have enough capital to pay up if their bets go wrong. The exception in the current bill for so-called customized derivatives opens a loophole big enough for bankers to drive their Ferraris through. Second, the bill should resurrect the Glass-Steagall Act in its entirety, so commercial banks are separated from investment banks. The current bill doesn't go nearly far enough. Commercial banks shouldn't be investing in the stock market, and investment banks shouldn't be taking in deposits. We learned this after the great crash of 1929 and then forgot it in 1999 when Glass-Steagall was repealed because Wall Street wanted to create financial supermarkets. Third, the bill should cap the size of big banks at no more than $100 billion in assets. The current bill doesn't limit the size of banks at all. It creates a process for winding down the operations of a bank that gets into trouble, but if several big banks are threatened, as they were when the housing bubble burst, they'd almost certainly be bailed out. And knowing this, they'll take bigger risks than they should. The only way to ensure no bank is too big to fail is to make sure no bank is too big, period. Wall Street doesn't want these reforms because they cut deeply into profits and is using its formidable lobbying clout with both parties to prevent even a decent discussion of them. It's time for Main Street, tea partiers, coffee partiers, and beer drinkers to be heard.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Do take a second to send us your thoughts, whatever your beverage of choice. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. We heard a lot about risk during the financial crisis, how there was too much of it on Wall Street and not enough respect for it in the rest of the economy. Risk does have its more common applications, though. It makes entrepreneurs take the chances they do, for instance. It's why some people love to ski those double black diamond runs on the backside of the hill where nobody's patrolling. And it is why, in the final analysis, why Las Vegas exists. While he was playing and winning at the blackjack tables in Vegas, Josh Axelrad used to write commentaries for us. He's got a new book out now about his former life. It's a memoir called Repeat Until Rich, a professional card counter's chronicle of the blackjack wars. Josh, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
It bears mention right at the beginning that you started on Wall Street and somehow wound up as a professional blackjack player. How did that happen?
Well, honestly, the thing that I was most confounded by was the fact that I started on Wall Street. It's not where I was trying to end up. It was an accidental situation. And needless to say, I was not embracing it so much. I was dreaming of other things, although it was very hard for me to precisely define what those things were until I met a person at a party with some friends who had counted cards.
And you meet a guy at a party, you start talking, you find out more about this blackjack thing, and then you wind up at a very sort of parallel place in the blackjack world, right? You were a Wall Street analyst, and you wind up on this crew of professional blackjack players doing very much that thing, sort of entry level, right? Describe that for me.
One thing that happens in blackjack is that over time, you become known to casinos. So over time, it becomes more and more difficult to play. And one solution to that problem for organized blackjack players is what my team chose to do, which was to bring together experienced players who had bankroll with less experienced people like I was at the time, who have clean faces, but not necessarily bankroll or much know-how. So that's how I came in. I was a clean face.
So give us the thumbnail then of how card counting works, because that's sort of relevant to this whole thing.
In this particular game, there are certain cards in the deck that are disproportionately favorable to players. And what that means is that if you happen to run into a situation where, because of the random, you know, permutations of the way the cards were combined during the shuffle, wind up with a deck, or, you know, in casinos these days, they usually play with multiple decks combined into what are usually called shoes, either six decks or eight decks. So you wind up with a shoe in which there's an abnormally high concentration of those good cards, the player favorable cards. Mm-hmm. The house edge will actually disappear. And what card counters do is that they track that concentration and they win money by increasing their bet size dramatically when they find a favorable deck.
So what's it like in the casino as this is happening?
Well, we would play in different styles, but in the classic play that we used a good bit, there would be a group of us, maybe three or four counters sitting at different tables, and they would be betting table minimum trying to blend in. And there would be one additional figure known as the big player, the BP in blackjack parlance, whose job was to place large bets. And the counters, when they found a favorable shoe, they would signal that big player through some, you know, conventional gesture like lighting a cigarette, something that would look normal in a casino. And the big player would be looking for that signal from those individuals and would swoop down on the table and start throwing in very large bets.
Yeah, and so you have these setups in the casinos. And then behind it, the thing that was interesting to me was you have almost a syndicate. You have investors who put up money. You have folks who aren't even, you know, within 5,000 miles of the casino, but they're sort of backing you guys, bankrolling you guys.
One of the things that turns out to be the case is that investment in well-run blackjack operations is reasonably desirable because the returns are decent. They're not stellar. You don't typically become a millionaire from counting cards, but you can earn expected returns of 4% or 5% for a few days of play. And when you annualize that figure, it turns into something that's very hard to beat.
And so there is a career path. You work your way up until eventually you in the book become a BP, right? A big player.
That's true. And in the beginning, that opportunity was not available to me, in part because I was early on, I was the youngest player they had on the team. And I looked a little bit odd. My character was sort of odd. Like, I wasn't actually a normal casino goer. And I was growing dreadlocks at the time. I was a little bit of a freak. So I didn't think I could sort of fill the role. But over time, I did step up to that role. And as a result of that, become increasingly hot myself, so that I too saw my playing opportunities begin to diminish. So there was a career path, but over the very long run, it is difficult to stay ahead of the casinos all the time.
Josh Axelrod, his book is called Repeat Until Rich. Josh, thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you very much.
If you want to find the commentary Josh did for us, go to our website, search for the name Lee Aaron Blair from a couple of years ago. We let him use a pseudonym, we should tell you, so that his name and his face would stay clean, as he said with the casinos while he was playing. Coming up, fighting global warming down on the farm.
From natural gas, which is used to make fertilizer, LP gas, which we use to dry grain, the diesel fuel we use to run our equipment, all those things should be appreciably higher.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials added 7 points today. That's basically nothing percentage-wise. Finished at 11,124. The NASDAQ bumped up 4 points, a tenth percent, closed at 2504. The S&P 500 lost a point. That's about a tenth percent. Ended things at 1205. Apple announced BAFO sales after last night's bell, clicked up 6% today. Boeing soared up nearly 4%. Morgan Stanley also banked a 4% gain. Financials mostly down, though. Wells Fargo lost 2%. Bank of America gave back 1.75%. Citigroup and Goldman Sachs each lost less than 1% today. Yahoo down 5% after missing analyst projections. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note dropped to 3.74%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Citrix, offering Go to My PC, allowing users to work from anywhere via the web. More at gotomypc.com/market. By the New Harvard Business Review, a source of smart thinking for today's business world. The revival of smart begins at hbr.org. And by MassMutual, offering retirement and 401k plans to businesses for more than 60 years. MassMutual.com/retirestrong. What does setting interest rates have in common with driving a car? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The National Association of Realtors reports on existing home sales for March. The Senate Rules and Administration Committee examines the history of the filibuster. And it's Take Our Daughters and Sons to Work Day. Not into it? Do something for Earth Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. There were some doings in the world of plastic today. Visa announced it's going to buy the online payment processing firm CyberSource for about $2 billion. The real target there, though, is PayPal, the 800-pound gorilla of online processors. Visa wants to do more business on the web. And that is a good thing, since it's been dumped by one of its biggest real-world customers. Target says it's going to stop issuing Visa Target cards next week. Instead, it's going to issue its own cards that can be used only in its own stores. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith explains.
Would you like to save 15% on your purchase today by opening a credit card with us?
It's the pitch that launched half a billion store credit cards and more than $140 billion worth of charges. But store cards are about more than just charges, says Nick Bork. He heads up the Save Credit Cards project for the Pew Health Group.
It's part of a bigger strategy. It's really about driving people to come into your store more often and to spend more money at your store.
It works.
Target said customers who used store brand credit cards spent more money at the store than customers who had Target visas they could use anywhere. But enough about Target. Bork says store cards are all about getting to know us.
They can tie together your purchase history with your in-store sales receipts, so they can learn more about what things you like to buy, what sort of profile you fit.
But what's in it for us? Aside from the 15% discount, the cards have to be used in store, and their interest rates tend to be high. Ben Woolsey is with creditcards.com. He says the credit crunch helped drive a lot of customers to store cards.
Some of the major card issuers were cutting back on credit lines and closing accounts proactively. That actually created more interest for some of the private label cards.
Woolsey says store cards are able to get around some of the strict new credit card regulations. So customers who have trouble getting a Visa or American Express card might still be able to get a store card. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Assuming they finish financial reform this week, and yes, we know that is quite an assumption. Next up on the Senate's agenda is a climate change bill. Could be introduced as soon as Monday. Details are sketchy, even at this late date. But we can safely say it's going to extract some kind of a price from industrial America for burning fossil fuels that are linked to global warming. Thing is, industry means different things depending on where you are in this country, a fact not lost on Congress in its deal-making. Today, we're going to look at the farming industry, and Jay Field reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
The story of agriculture and climate change is really a tale about two farmers. Both farm corn and soybeans. Both come from families that have farmed for generations. But spend time with each, and you hear two very different takes on global warming and what cutting carbon emissions would do to farming.
Truck to the left is a semi we use to haul grain to the elevator in the fall.
Mark Hines and I are talking climate change next to an 18-wheeler on his farm in Downs, a small town in central Illinois. No matter how the legislation shapes up, the price of fuel will rise. Hines doesn't like that idea one bit.
I mean, everything from natural gas, which is used to make fertilizer, LP gas, which we use to dry grain, the diesel fuel we use to run our equipment, all those things should be appreciably higher.
It costs Hines about $14,000 a year just to run his tractors, semis, and other machines. The last thing he wants is to pay even more to fight global warming, a problem he doesn't believe is worth worrying about right now.
Maybe 100 years out, there will be a larger effect, but I don't see any problem with it in the near future.
Lots of farmers feel like Hines does, and for them, the fight over climate change is a fight for survival.
Our costs are going to increase.
That's Rick Krause, chief congressional lobbyist for the American Farm Bureau Federation, the largest organization representing farmers in the U.S.
We're kind of put at a disadvantage in world markets because our costs are higher and we can't sell our products.
But sources in Washington say lawmakers know a quick transition to a clean economy is impossible. So they're offering farmers some financial help. Congress plans to limit carbon emissions. That means big polluters will have to have permits. But these polluters will also be able to cancel out some of their emissions by, say, paying farmers to burn switchgrass instead of coal in their boilers or swap out some cropland for trees. Rick Krause at the Farm Bureau says those proposals aren't good enough.
While they might help people, they're not really going to fully defray all of the cost increases that we're going to see.
The stakes for agriculture are not as high as they have sometimes suggested.
Dan Estee runs the Yale Center for Law and Environmental Policy. He says some industries will need more of a cushion than others in making a gradual transition away from fossil fuels. But he says farmers, who've gotten generous federal subsidies for years, are well positioned to make the switch.
And I think it's really critical that agriculture be asked to play a role, as everyone else is, to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Which brings us to the second farmer in our story.
My name is Jaron Rundahl, and I'm 83 years old. I'll be 84 the 14th of June.
Rundahl and his sons farm more than 2,000 acres in Coon Valley, a small town in southwestern Wisconsin, not far from the Mississippi River. Rundahl has a very different view from Mark Hines down in Illinois. Rundahl believes the science on climate change and says America is the biggest polluter in the world. He knows a bill to cut carbon emissions means higher fuel prices. He's not thrilled about it, but
if you do nothing, things get worse. And if there is a real problem, whether it's my problem or my neighbor's problem, we have to work on it.
It's something Rundahl has been trying to do for years now.
We're no-till farmers, so we don't till the soil. We just go in and plant, fertilize, plant, and then put on our herbicides, and then go back in and harvest.
The method traps carbon in the ground instead of releasing it into the air.
A number of years ago, my son said, there's something called carbon credits. So I said, I'll check that.
Rundahl called the Chicago Climate Exchange, where polluters can volunteer to cut greenhouse gases by a certain amount. If they fall short, they buy credits from farmers like Rundahl, who get paid for their no-till planting.
We're the first in Wisconsin to sign up for carbon credits.
That was in 2006. The farm made several thousand dollars that first year. Rundahl welcomes a financial carrot to help him in his transition to a carbon-free world. Some believe the free market was the cause of all this pollution in the first place, and they also believe the free market can play a role in cleaning it up. In Coon Valley, Wisconsin, I'm Jay Field for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Trusted Choice Independent Insurance Agents, offering a choice of companies and coverage. You can find a local agent at 1-800-WE-INSURE. By Deluxe Corp, a partner to more than 4 million small businesses with logo design, websites, email marketing, and online networking. Deluxe.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
A final note today, a surefire way to know exactly how much Wall Street banks care about the financial reform bill the Senate's set to take up. Follow the money. Last night, as it happens, was the deadline for political action committees to file their March reports with the Federal Elections Commission. Who gave how much to whom, in other words? Bloomberg News has done some digging through the filings. The Goldman Sachs Committee, just to, you know, pick a name in the news, gave more than $290,000 to candidates for federal office last month. That's almost 10 times as much as they gave in February. Goldman's straight-out political lobbying work doubled over the same period a year ago. The actual reform bill, as we've said, is set to hit the Senate floor tomorrow. The president's going to New York to give a big speech. We'll tell you all about it on the broadcast tomorrow. But for now, we got to go. That's Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday. Today, the Dow put on 7 points. That's really not worth mentioning percentage-wise. The Nasdaq added 4 points, about a 10%. The S&P 500 lost a single point, about a 10% there as well. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this broadcast, the Indian caste system makes its way to England.
I had two guys who were from higher caste joining my department. And when they found that I was from a low caste, things started going absolutely haywire.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.